Now, again, I'm going back to the pronunciations. Is it Sherrod? Is that the way your first name is pronounced? Sherrod. Okay, so beautiful.
That's fine.
Meanwhile, I've been meeting like 100 people named Vijay. All of a sudden, that's a very popular
name. Oh, really?
But Sherrod. Okay. Stuart, we are actually ready to go. We're good. So... Yes, so we're going to be quiet now, and then you're going to hear music. I'll introduce the whole show. I'll introduce you, and we're going to start with the usual question, I think, which is genetics destiny? And, of course, I know your answer is no, and you'll talk about it, okay?
Yes.
All right, Stu, here we go.
When I look in the mirror, I don't see wrinkles. When I look in the mirror, I see hair on my head, not my shoulder.
Yes, he does, because maybe he's in denial. Hello, hello, hello. This is Adrienne Berg, and this is Generation Bold. And we don't deny anything here about successful aging. We look at it right in the eye, and we say, is there something we can do in our own lives that can make our long future even longer and even better as we live it? And so we bring the best of the best from all over the world to give you that kind of information. And I am so pleased today that we have Dr. Sherrod Paul. Now, Dr. Paul is an author, The Genetics of Health, Understand Your Genes for Better Health, and that's Atria Books. And more, that, by the way, that book just came out. Pub date is April 2017, so you've heard it here first. And the fact is that genetics is probably the one thing we think we're stuck with, that there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. But Dr. Paul says otherwise, and as we speak with him today, we're going to unravel some of his many awards. You're going to see that he is the person that you should be thinking about listening to, because he is not just a great storyteller, not just a skin cancer surgeon, a family physician, but he's a real leader in this idea of evolutionary biology. So, Dr. Paul, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, let's start with that concept, though. Are we stuck with our genes? Is genetics destiny?
Genetics, we should consider it more like a blueprint, but not our destiny. I think, you know, we can escape our genes just like, I suppose, we can escape good or bad childhoods or good or bad parents. So, you know, it takes some effort, but absolutely, genes, we can express new genes.
Now, you know, you talk about parents. You have you hail from what we call Down Under. You've gotten major awards from New Zealand and Australia and all over the world. Is there a difference in thinking of people who are aging in those relatively young countries as opposed to, let's say, here in the U.S. or in Europe, where we may be more resigned to our futures? It seems to me that a lot of innovation is coming out of your part of the world when it comes to genetics and aging.
I think, firstly, I must say that, you know, we're all, I think even the U.S. is a young country relatively, you know, compared to the, you know, Asian and European civilizations, I guess. So I certainly think, you know, if we're talking about longevity, which I just heard you mention in the introduction,
yes,
then we can take some lessons from some of the older civilizations, like, you know, you can see the Japanese, you can see in Italy, in Sardinia, in Icaria, in Greece. These are all places we call the blue zones of the world, where people live for very long and happy and healthy. But interestingly, while there is a lot of interest in this topic in, you know, Australia and New Zealand, and we also are not blue zones, even though we try to be.
Ah, interesting because we have had the author of Blue Zones on, and there have been many people on our show who tried to create blue zones in different parts of the country, even very locally. And that simply means that an entire community is eating differently, exercising differently, socializing differently for healthy aging. So let's go back to the genetics of health, specifically the name of your book, Dr. Paul. One of the things we do like to learn about here in the U.S. is how to eat right. How do you connect that with genetics?
Yeah, I think firstly, our genes, you know, the more natural you eat or the more unprocessed you eat, obviously it's better for you because our genes evolved, our basic genes evolved a long time ago when man couldn't process food or industrialize food. So I think to a large degree, one of our problems has been a lot of processed food. So even, for example, we were just talking about, you know, longevity blue zones. In America, there is one which is in Loma Linda and California, and of course because there's a large Seventh-day Adventist population, so they mostly ate fish, a lot of vegetables, hardly drank any alcohol, but ate very little or no red meat. So I think those sort of things, and also, you know, a lot of our meat and things have become processed and modified. So I think all these, every time we add a chemical, which is a new chemical, then our body learns to detoxify it, and sometimes it has to express new genes. See, if you think about genes, genes are nothing but little bits of you know, DNA which really express proteins or produce proteins, and these proteins then go on and cause other functions. So, for example, in the book I talk about testing myself for the caffeine gene, because as you know, caffeine was again an acquired relatively new gene when people started drinking coffee or eating coffee beans. And caffeine is detoxified in the body, and some people have a gene which can, you know, metabolize it quicker and some people slower and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, the message is you are what you eat to some degree.
So let's take a look at this gene testing. First of all, in some areas, the waters in which I swim, where people are really talking about longevity all the time, their gerontologists and their doctors and their, even like myself, financial gerontologists, who's going to pay for all of this, we talk about gene testing all the time. Now, I don't know that that's a mainstream topic, but I'd like to make it mainstream for all of my listeners. And in this particular case, I know that we can test for the best foods. That does work for you, like you did even on yourself. You looked at the caffeine gene. We can even test for the best exercises for ourselves. I don't think people understand how the test itself goes and what they can do about it once they get results.
Okay, so basically, yeah, you're right. You know, based on a genetic analysis, you can, you know, indeed eat for your gene type or also exercise for your gene type. So what it is, you know, the gene test is typically done just on a sample of saliva, which or a swab inside your mouth, but typically a little bit of saliva is collected, and we analyze it, and then after a few weeks, you get a report which is personalized for you. So if you look at the exercise genes, the things which we know are some people are genetically predisposed to endurance exercise and some people have genes which favor power exercises. So in other words, some people are endurance-like. Their genes are meant for running really long distances and some people are really meant to just do weights and things like that. I mean, which we probably intuitively we do have a feeling. But sometimes, you know, if we've just become couch potatoes over our lifetimes, that we probably don't even know what sort of exercise is better for us. But here's the interesting thing, is when studies were done even on mice who were put on endurance exercise, they produced a substance called BDNF, or bone-derived neurotrophic factor, which actually improves memory, brain function. So actually doing some endurance exercise in general expresses genes which even can help your memory. So, for example, there may be more to it than the phrase jogging your memory. So you literally can do that.
That's a very fascinating. Jogging your memory is an idiom that we use, and it's very possible that if you jog, you jog your memory. I love it, and I know there are these kinds of real deep understanding in the book, The Genetics of Health. Understand your genes for better health. And, of course, that's Dr. Sherrod Pohl's latest book. You know, I'm going to tell you, to reveal to you, I recently was in Thailand in a wonderful medical facility called Bumrungrat, which is in Bangkok. And what they do is they do this kind of testing. And I haven't had it done, and my plan has been to do that. And one of my hopes and dreams is that I'll learn the kind of exercise that's best for me. So here's my question. If you know the best exercise for yourself, and this is a funny question, doctor, are you better off doing that exercise countering? I'll tell you why. When we read about cognitive fitness and how to make sure our mind stays alert, we're really told to do what is not easy for us. We're told to, if you don't know how to play an instrument, play an instrument. If you're not good at languages, learn languages, because it changes the neurons in the brain. It's counterintuitive. Don't do what's easy for you. Is that the same or different when you learn about your genes? Should you go with the flow?
Yeah, actually, a bit of both, actually. It's a very, very good question. And actually, what you said was very true as well. So, for example, let's say you have the power gene. If you still did endurance exercise, it will still literally jog your memory and it will still make you sharper for the very reason. But what these genes actually test for is, like, some people have specifically a variant of the same BDNF, which makes them more resistant to exercise. So we can also tell, it's almost like saying it's a sluggish gene or a little laziness gene. So you may be more likely to drop out of your gym classes, or you're going to be finding it very difficult to motivate yourself. So what it means is, you know, there's nothing wrong in having a friend motivate you, things like that. But you're right, you know, like I said, genes are not your destiny. So just because you have one, it doesn't mean you can't do other forms of exercise, but it will tell you what form you're most suited for, which means that you probably will be better at it.
And easier. All right, well, we're going to take a little break now. We're going to come back and we're going to dance. Yes, we are going to dance with Dr. Sherrod Pohl and tell you why that's so important. We already spoke about the laziness or procrastination gene. So maybe give you not an excuse, but a break.
You may think that
we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
But that doesn't bother me, not even a bit, because I am happy. And I freely admit I'm inappropriate for my age. Da 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 da. Da 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 da.
Okay, Stuart, we did very well. This is terrific. We're going to reset the clock now. And, okay. Also, in addition to the book, is there any website that you would like me to talk about?
Yeah, you could just go to my website, which got some information on all the things we talked about and some, you know, previous books and other little health snippets and things. So it's just,
drsherrodpohl.com.
Yeah,
Sherrod
Pohl,
not doctor.
Yeah,
not doctor.
Both go to the same. Yeah. Both go to the same, so it doesn't matter.
Okay, good. All right, Stuart, we're good.
You may think that I'm full of it, but that doesn't bother me, not even a bit, because I am happy, and I freely admit I'm inappropriate for my age.
And hello, hello, hello. Once again, this is Adrienne Berg, and this is Generation Bold, the Fountain of Truth. The Fountain of Truth about what? The Fountain of Truth about aging. And I'm here today with Dr. Sherrod Pohl. Now, I know you're going to want to follow up on some of the things that he's presenting at the show today. So here's a few ways. First, easiest, of course, is to get his latest book, The Genetics of Health, Understand Your Genes for Better Health. It's an Atria book, and it'll be on Amazon, ask your bookstores, whatever you prefer. You can also get more of his writings and hints and tips and important pieces of information on his website, which is SherrodPohl.com. And let me spell that, Sharad Pohl, PAUL.com. You know, he is a Renaissance man, and if you don't believe me, just read New Zealand's Herald's Canvas magazine. He's a polymath, so stated by Good magazine. We're going to find out what that is in a minute. And he's won many, many awards. The problem is they are so international that they're hard to pronounce. He's got incredible amounts of bio here. Adjunct professor at Auckland University of Technology, And he's really a person who cares about what he's saying and its impact on people, not just to be heard, but to make a difference. So let's go back. And what I know, Dr. Paul, you try to do is make things very accessible for people, because really, this is a deep, deep medical, biomedical topic. So you talk about dancing and stress and genetics. Let's have some fun. Tell me about that.
Yeah, dance is probably, I mean, if you stop to think about it, dance was probably one of the most earliest forms of exercise, because if you think when people were hunter-gatherers, I think they often celebrated a kill, which was not very often, so food was not as easy to get as today, by dancing around their kill and things like that. So you know, there's a lot of evidence that probably the first known forms of exercise were really just dance, because people were not exercising for pleasure as we do, but they were exercising for daily living, because you know, you had to hunt prey, you had to chase them, you had to walk distances in search of food. So exercise was really a necessity. So probably dance was a pleasurable form. So the next step is, as we said, constantly what we do, our lifestyles and our actions impact our genes. And so certain different dance forms express different genes and actually do different things to us. So, for example, if you look at even movement, you know, things like yoga, which are postural exercises, and, you know, yoga has become so popular worldwide, it actually reduces stress and brings down your blood pressure. But that's pretty much what we know from the science that it does. I mean, a lot of the other things are stated, but we haven't proven that. Then you look at Tai Chi, you know, the martial art dance kind of form in China, and that improves your balance and reduces falls when you get older. So that's, we know that does that. But the best form of exercise to reduce dementia, improve Parkinson's disease, all that kind of thing, is actually tango. And you see, there is, you know, the Argentinian tango.
I do know, yes.
That's it. And the reason is because if you think about why we move or how we move, human movement is fundamentally two-legged. See, most animals are on four legs, so we become on two legs. And the second thing is, so walking on two legs, we do three things. One is locomotion, which is moving forward. Second thing is orienting, you know, we're balancing. And the third fundamental animal reflex is the grasping reflex. That's why infants grasp. And in tango, you know, you hook yourself against your partner. So it was funny, I was in New York last week at the book launch, and in the audience happened to be a guy called Paul Pellicoro, who taught Al Pacino to dance and scent off a woman, or so he told me. So even when I finished this, speaking about dance as part of introducing the book, so he rushed forward and we had a little impromptu tango lesson. So there you go.
Oh, well, for those of you who missed Scent of a Woman and terrific tango, the major issue there was that this gentleman was blind, and he was able to dance and fulfill one of his many goals in life, even though he was not sighted. It's a fantastic movie. Watch it. I want to go back to this, though. First of all, I've had the pleasure of traveling a good deal and doing Tai Chi in Shanghai fairly recently. And what was interesting to me was this was totally unorganized. Everybody came. Just the, you know, it was a certain time in the morning, the park was open, people were coming from all over. And you didn't have necessarily a leader, nobody paid $12 for the session. They were just older adults, and then they danced. And my husband and I were together, and we actually danced in the park with them. It wasn't just Tai Chi, it was Tai Chi and dancing. This is very recent, this is within this year. I also have a friend who does something called Barefoot Adventures, where she goes and people learn native dances. So I just want to ask you about this. When I go with her, these dances are not easy. This is not a little Zumba class. People who are doing native dances are really exercising. There's a lot of sweat, I'll tell you that. There's a lot of energy. Do you think that that originally, because these dances were ritual and spiritual, they were so hard fought that they were really exercises in disguise, not dance?
Yes, I think there's a mix. I mean, I think it's a vicious cycle, because the genes for positivity when you dance. So, for example, dancing is not only aerobic, so it's actually a great form of aerobic exercise, but like we just discussed, because when you're dancing, unlike, say, if you're running on a treadmill or something else, you can switch off after a while because you no longer need to keep orienting yourself. Whereas in dance forms, you not only are moving, you're orienting and you're grasping, so you're constantly exercising your brain. So you really, for a start, it's exercise for the brain and mind. And I think when people were doing that, it took them to another plane. And so you're right. So probably it also became, you know, meditative in a way. But the other thing to remember with dance forms are because they're constantly variable. So your muscles and your brain doesn't get constantly used to the same thing. Because even if you're doing the same dance, you know, you're moving to different parts of the room or the park or. So you're doing different things, whereas, you know, it's very easy for us to get habituated with one form of exercise and literally our brain gets bored.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I am too. I remember my mom said a funny thing, but it's so true. She was about 90 and she was taking a stress test where you go on treadmill. And they said, oh, you did really well, Gertrude. She said, you know what? I would have done better if there was anything to see.
Yeah.
So she was really expressing the fact that there was no engagement here. Just the feet were moving. And I think that helps a lot of our listeners because you don't always have to go to a gym. You don't always have to do the same boring 20 minutes dancing to any kind of music by yourself at home. With others, in a group, it all works. And before we end our segment here, I just want to prelude the next part of this and give you a fair warning, Dr. Paul. There are a couple of articles in the New York Times. One is that doctors are using robots instead of patients to practice, and young people are not going in to observe. They're using robots. And another that stethoscopes are getting longer because people don't want to be that close to their doctor, a little peculiar fact. Well, how come doctors don't talk about genetics? How come we never have this discussion with our doctor? When we come back, Dr. Paul is going to share with us how we can maybe have such a discussion or where is the right place for us to go to really think and talk about these kinds of things. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You may think that I'm full of it, but that doesn't bother me, not even a bit. I am happy, and I freely admit I'm inappropriate for my age. Da 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 da, da 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 da.
Hello. Okay. So, in our next segment, we're going to talk about that. I mean, we've done a couple of shows on genetics, and there are plenty of books out for the public. But I still, to this minute, have never had a doctor talk to me about it. And if I have mentioned it to one of my doctors, you know, it's not in their ballpark, we'll say. I mean, we're off the air, so I'm just saying this to you.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know how the how does the average person, again, off the air, I'm saying to you, there's 23andMe, there's all these things on the internet, but I don't know what's right. We have doctors who charge anywhere from maybe up to $5,000 for all your tests. In this Bamrangrad, they've got a package which is like $1,200. Just for the average person who's middle class, has some money, is interested in this, I don't know what they should do. Will you be able to help with that question?
Yeah, absolutely. Because like, as we said, we do a test. But having said that, there are many out there, and I haven't checked out all of them, but I can give you a general guide. And also we can explain why medicine is a bit slow to respond, because, you know, medicine is like law. It's sometimes a bit slow to respond because, you know, I've said in the book that just like law doesn't always translate to justice, medicine isn't health. Health is something you have to take some personal responsibility. And
I know we're going to discuss that. I know we'll also have time in this segment to talk about the anxiety of taking the test.
Yes.
Because maybe we'll find out that we're about to have cancer or we're going to have Alzheimer's. And
that's why, I think those tests are different. So I pretty much, the one I do, which is called the 21 gene test, which is based on the book, is simply stress, diet, exercise. So it helps, like you would know if you ate protein, could you lose weight? Some people can't do that. If you eat fat, do you put on weight? What kind of fat? Can you digest coffee? Are you intolerant to lactose or gluten? So we just do the ones which help you live your life better without being, you know, stressed about it. But I agree, some of
right.
the dangerous because we don't know
the
answer.
We have to go on now, but what you were just starting to say about dangerous, about knowing the answers and so on, let us make sure we make the distinction so they don't get scared away. Okay?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Very good. Do we already?
Think that I'm full of it, but that doesn't bother me, not even a bit, cause I am happy, and I freely admit I'm inappropriate for my age. Da 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 da, da 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 da.
Well, let's be inappropriate for our age. Let's open up our mind to a whole new kind of science. It's the science of genetics. It's probably not so new, but it is new in the mainstream. And we just talked a little bit about the fact that we're getting farther and farther away from our doctors, not closer and closer. Honestly, I remember the days that my doctor came to our house. I was a little girl, and my mother would take out a towel, Dr. Sherrod. I was speaking with Dr. Sherrod, who's an international, let's say, spokesperson for the proper kind of genetic testing and an author of The Genetics of Health. Understand Your Genes for Better Health, Atria Books. It just came out. And if you want to learn more, there's SharadPaul.com, S-H-A-R-A-D, Paul, P-A-U-L.com. We're speaking with him, and I can remember the days, Doctor, when my family physician came to our house, and my mother would take out a towel, and she would put it on our credenza, because his bag, his black doctor's bag, had little pellets at the bottom, little brass balls, and she did not want them to scratch the credenza. Well, today, we don't know our doctors, and they certainly don't tell us anything about genetics. Are they going to catch up? How do we get into knowing how to get ourselves tested and really take a look at what the tests are for? This is what your book is about, so I know you have all this information for us.
Okay, a few things. And firstly, I think it's a real pity that we are far away from our doctors, because if you look at the name doctor, the origins are from docere in Latin, which means to teach. So the doctor should be your educator on how to live your life and for better health, which is what I've tried to do in the book. But the doctor shouldn't just be a medicine man. So one of the things I'd like to differentiate is, you know, I've said that, you know, medicine and law are very old-fashioned guilds. They have a similar sort of structure. They're a little rigid, a little slow to change. And, you know, law doesn't always translate to justice, especially if you don't have money. And sometimes, you know, medicine can be like that. It's an industry, so it doesn't translate into health without you taking personal responsibility. But having said that, how can you take personal responsibility in testing your genes? So firstly, understand what is it that you're testing for. So, for example, I myself do a 21 gene test, which is on my website, which the details, and that's based on my book. And it's purely simple to help you plan your lifestyle and diet according to your genes. So just like what we discussed earlier, we test your exercise genes, we test your food genes, right from all your vitamin. When we say vitamins, it's not actually your levels, but your predisposition to having a low particular vitamin, which may lead to other things. For example, a particular gene which is related to your folate, which is MTHFR, what it does is if you have abnormal variant of it, you're prone to having higher homocysteine, which can lead to heart disease. So basically, then you may need to modify your diet and eat plenty of folate vegetables or supplement yourself with folate. Similarly, you have people who have problems with particular vitamins. We also test for intolerances like gluten and lactose, because sometimes you may think it's the dairy causing you symptoms, but it may not be. And also even little other, you know, things like caffeine and, you know, so that's what I do. there are many other tests. You know, the entire genome has been mapped. And having said that, in my medical practice, when I'm dealing with complicated skin cancers, we sometimes test specific genes while planning oncological treatment. And so that's basically, we know some people with a particular gene may respond to a particular form of medication better. So that's sort of targeted therapy, and that's a different thing. But the dangerous one, in my view, is where we're testing for everything which we don't know how accurate they are. So people may be frightened about, you know, this is your risk for dementia, or this is your risk for, you know. There are many variables there, and it doesn't always pan out because we're expressing new genes all the time. So I think those are not yet state of the art, and I think so we have to be cautious. So I'm actually comfortable about things that help you plan your life so you take charge of your health. And I'm also comfortable with, if you're having specific treatment, to have targeted therapy. So, you know, for example, if you're going on blood thinners, we know there are genetic tests available which will tell you, are you more likely to have a complication? And I think that should be done, which is not done. So those sort of, that's a general guide, I think.
Yeah, one of the things I was most impressed by is the ability to design medications. And one day I think I'm going to really have a leading pharmacist on with us. It's one of the things I have not done yet, I have to admit to my listeners and to you, Dr. Paul, is to have a pharmacist on. Because once you know some of these things about yourself from your gene testing, it is possible to have what I call designer drugs, the kind of cholesterol drug that's better for you. But we don't have that. We're getting more and more generic because it's cheaper. So there is definitely a financial component here. But I think that one of the things I'm learning from my clients, and they are older people who are coming to our specialized firm for financial help, financial gerontology, is that their medications are making them sick. They would be thriving a lot better if they weren't having the side effects. Can genetic testing of the type you're talking about, like if you're taking your Plavix or your blood thinners, help in determining the right kind of medication or dosage for you, as well as some of these lifestyle changes?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I think the two areas where the gene test is very well developed is certainly for blood thinners and also for anti-inflammatory drugs, you know, like the so because people develop complications on both of them, and at the moment what we do, or what medicine does in general, is it gives everybody the medication when you think you need it, and then when somebody gets a complication, then you treat it, and then you adjust the dose or you stop the medication, but it actually costs a lot more. So in my view, the day is not very far away when, you know, certainly for those things, not only you will test them before so that you modify the dose or look for alternative treatments. So, I think that should really be done now. But I think, like you said, it's really because of the industry model that we're not doing it, simply because it costs more to do it. But I think it's actually we're being you know, penny-wise and pound-foolish, because I really think that if you think about it, if somebody ends up in the hospital with a complication, you know the cost in America, so, or even in any Western society. So, you know, I think it's foolish.
Well, you know, here are some words from a total non-doctor, me. Just in my observation, people are coming to us for financial advice and financial gerontology around, let's say, age 78, and we take their health history, and they're not taking any medicine. By the time they're 81, I don't have enough paper to write down all the medicines that have been prescribed for them, including stress reduction medicines, just because they're not feeling great. Well, you know, when you're 83 and all your friends are leaving, either they're dying or they're moving, and you're feeling a little decline, popping a pill is not always the right answer, but that's what happens. And then we begin to see the spiraling down. So I am all for not being what you say, penny-wise and pound-foolish, because it's costing us, at least in the U.S., a huge amount of money, not just in health care, but in uncovered health care, like people coming to your home for long-term care, non-skilled care, because of people who are down because of their medications aren't working for them. So I see the genetic testing in this arena, in addition to our lifestyle. And I really hope that there's some connection between what's covered which is the money side of what you're talking about and what you could do. Because what you're saying is, though, right now we can be very proactive and we can get the information about our genes for the right eating, for the dancing, for the exercise. And now I just want to ask you a little bit about stress reduction. Is there anything in our genetics that show us that we are more or less prone to stress? Because they're even talking about a happiness gene. What do you think of that?
Yes, I think there are a couple of things. Firstly, you know, stress is a natural evolutionary response. And, you know, it evolved 100,000 years ago, or, you know, as humanity evolved, because life was very dangerous. So we needed a warning system to warn us that there were predators around. So really, that's where they... And then the reason why the more I... And of course, some people, as with anything, you know, some people have more or less of anything. You know, some people are, you know, louder, or some people can sing better, some people can be more anxious. But the reason the anxious ones survived is because they were still in the caves. You know, the scary cats survived because they didn't take on the saber-toothed tigers. The brave among us charged out and said, I'm going to get the tiger, and, you know, guess who ended up not coming back? So really what happened is the anxiety was a survival gene, you know, so we always carry it with us even today. So even today, you know, our lives are actually much safer than they were 100.
Than they were, but we still get stressed. We're going to come back and talk a lot more about that. And I'm going to give you a very interesting insight into working after 50. Be back in a moment. For my age, da-da-da-da. Okay, so the music started properly, but it's okay. They patted down a little bit, so they'll be able to hear
That's
you
fine.
Even if you were talking over the music, okay?
That's fine.
All right, so believe it or not, we're in the last segment, which is 8 minutes long, and I just want to make sure, was there anything that I'm missing here that you want to cover?
No, I think you've... Done very good. I think this what we should talk, the stress is very important because that comes into, you know, our dopamine levels, and as a society, you know, how our diets and things can also make a difference there. And, you know, and what you were talking about, why we, there's nothing wrong in everything, there are little ups and downs, you know, that's just like the stock market. But why do we want to be, you know, bullish all the time, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's where the problem comes in, an obsession with super happiness. I think, like you said, you know, so what's wrong with a little off day?
As long as
you don't let it, yeah.
Let it control your life. No, absolutely. All right,
yeah.
So we are good. We're good. Adrienne Berg, and this is Generation Bold, the Fountain of Truth. And I have two little interesting tidbits of news that I think are beginning breakthroughs in two completely different arenas that deal with ageism. Now, if you go on our website, Generation Bold Radio, you'll see something called the Ageism Police, where we blow the whistle on ageist practices or advertising, materials, movies, television. But every once in a while, we also applaud anti-ageism. And I got two quickies for you today. First of all, one of them is organ donors. Yes, there was a time, and there still is, that doctors will reject a healthy organ because of the age of the donor. And that's no longer the case. They're taking a look at the fact that for the older recipient, an older organ that's healthy might be right. They just did a wonderful replacement, a kidney replacement, for a 64-year-old gentleman with the kidney of an 84-year-old woman. And in fact, they're not so keen on the younger organs because that means that the person who's the donor has many, many years that they have to go without let's say one kidney or whatever the organ that they're donating is. So that's very, very interesting. They're really not looking at age per se, but the actual impact of age. Now, that's a big, big step in anything, because we always look at the number. We don't look at what it really means. And last but not least, there's really some hard-hitting application of the Older Americans Act, which starts at the age of 40. You cannot discriminate against people because of age under that act in employment, except that it's never enforced, and there's going to be some more enforcement going on, so I'm happy to hear that. Now let's go back to what we were talking about. We're talking with Dr. Sherrod Paul, an international Renaissance man. It's been said that reading Dr. Paul's book is like taking an exhilarating journey through the shifting landscape of genetics, health, and evolution. We've actually been talking a lot about evolution. This comes from Pulitzer Prize winner Siddhartha Mukherjee, I think I'm right with that one. But yep. The point is he's talking about Dr. Paul, and one of the things he says is, and evolution. So, Dr. Paul, we just ended up in our last segment with you actually talking about evolution and stress and how the caveman or Neanderthal man, original man, actually got protected because of stress. But today, as you mentioned, we don't have woolly mammoths after us. We have other little things all day long after us. How does that relate to genetics, and how should we be handling that? Is that serious, or is it now just part of life?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, the stress is, normal, a part of life, but it's the stress response that we use, which is inappropriate. So, for example, you know, we're driving and somebody just, I often think, you know, so what? That's not a saber to a tiger or to get you. So, but you actually stimulate the same response in getting angry and getting, you know, your pulse racing. So I think same thing with children doing something you don't want them to do. So I think the way you look at it is, you know, like I love the thing you say that you're a financial gerontologist, because my wife is a geriatrician or a gerontologist, and I must tell her I didn't realize they were financial gerontologists.
Yep.
Yeah, very good. So you know, just like you're looking at the stock market, you know, it goes up and down, and it doesn't mean you immediately pull out your stocks every time it has a little blip. And it's the same thing with the stress response. You know, some days you're happier and some days you're a little more anxious, but the idea is to ride it out and not let it affect your overall health. And that's where being being a little mindful helps. So genetically, yes, people who have a certain gene, it's a COMT gene, a particular variant of it, are more likely to be anxious. But also, certain variants of this gene also determine a response to faith. So, for example, Ted Kapchuk in Harvard, he did a study where they put people on migraine pills, on acupuncture, and on a dummy pill, a third, a third, a third. And they found that the people on the migraine pill got better, on the dummy pill, no one got better, and on acupuncture, about 50% got better. But what he had done is it actually reversed it. So the people who were on the dummy pill were the ones who got better. But when they tested these people, they found they had a specific gene. So I think in the book I say it's like having the faith gene. So I suppose, you know, so if you have it, you know, there's nothing wrong about it. It just means you're more likely to believe things. But you can use it to your advantage, you know, by you're more likely to respond to body work, acupuncture, other treatments, alternative, and that's fine. And also, you know, meditation. If you have a gene which is likely to be more stressed, then take up yoga, meditation, all those things which lower your stress level.
So this gives you a benchmark as to what things are really important to you and just what's a trend that you happen to be following. And that's a very, very big difference, because we do follow trends. We'll do yoga for a while and then we'll drop it. We'll do Zumba for a while, or we'll meditate for a while, and we'll drop, and we wonder. And then, of course, we get stressed, doctor, because we berate ourselves for, but maybe it's because it's not really doing us all that much good. And we would be able to find out what much more realistically what we need. And, you know, you mentioned the stress response. Believe it or not, this stress response is a big part of financial gerontology too. The amygdala, the part of the brain that is that flight-fight response that you're talking about, is one of the most primitive parts of the brain. And it tends to be very prominent as you age. People get afraid. They get afraid of what's going on in the world. They get afraid of the market. They get afraid to make their own decisions about money. And the average financial person will respond to that, oh, they're old. They're just old. You know, well, maybe they're not even competent. But it's actually a natural part of brain function. And if people understand that, they can help others make much better decisions, too. So it's amazing to me how every person on my show is really of one piece. There's a connection in all these cases. Now, I wanted to finish this with the issue of the happiness gene, and I know we only have a few seconds for you to say something that was very profound, which was basically, it is what it is. Can you just express it in your own way?
Yes, you know, I think, you know, we're obsessed with happiness, just like with everything else. You know, I think, you know, happiness is not, it's something, it should be an accomplishment, not an aim. Like money, I think I often said money should be an accomplishment, not an aim, so you don't stress about it and just work towards it and it happens. Same thing with happiness. I think we're obsessed with it. So a lot of our foods tend to be addictive, high sugar, high dopamine foods because
right, we want a feel-good society.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
I know we're going to be ending now. I'm so sorry, but it's been wonderful. And you know what I'm going to say? Get out there, kids, and make it happen. Okay, very, very good. I love
Thank
this.
You.
I know that we're going to get good responses from this particular one. And the only thing that I am going to do is, I got a very nice press release from your folks, but I didn't get the book yet. So I personally had no trouble today because they did such a good job on your background and, you know, what to ask and all that. But I'm going to ask them to send the book because I personally would love to read it.
Oh, I thought they should have. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it doesn't happen, but I will ask. They did a particularly good job, though, on the press release.
All right.
That's wonderful. Okay, and I'm going to go tango. That's
Excellent.
What I'm going to do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay,
Lovely talking to you.
It's wonderful. Thank
you. Thank
you.
Bye-bye.